Hey. Well, good morning.
That was very aggressive.
Thank you. That was enthusiastic. I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Children, Families, Finance, and Policy Committee. Welcome to all. We have a number of members who are running late, but we do now have a quorum, which is good as we get started. So I think we'll just get going then with business as opposed to walking through the roll calls. I know we're missing a number of folks. But as I say, we do have a quorum. We will start with approval of the minutes. If I may have a motion to approve the minutes of the April 9th meeting of our committee.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, represent. Representative Lawrence. So, Representative Lawrence, you'd like to move
Mr.
approval?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the minutes, please.
Thank you, Representative Lawrence. So, Representative Lawrence moves approval of the minutes of our April 9th meeting. Any additions or corrections anybody has? I'm not seeing any. So, all in favor of approval of the motion from Representative Lawrence to approve those April 9th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, nope. The motion passes. Congratulations, Representative Lawrence. Well done, sir, and so glad, right? We have approved minutes. So, members, the plan for today and for this week, just to kind of check in on this, last week we heard a presentation on the administration's budget proposal on the human services side of our budget. We're going to have some remarks this morning on the early education side of our budget from Commissioner Jett. And then the plan is to hear a walkthrough of my proposal for our committee's budget bill for the session. So we'll walk through that, the contents, both the wording in the bill, but then also spreadsheet as well, and then receive public testimony, answer questions about the content of the bill, and then we will save a marker of the bill, including amendments, for Thursday. The bill will then go to Ways and Means, and then go on from there, and as is often the case in our committee, it gets a little complicated, and we're very happy to answer questions and talk that through. Are there questions that anybody has regarding the process for this week or otherwise?
Mr. Chair, quick question.
Yeah, but Representative Lawrence.
Just because it's not on my calendar,
yeah,
you were going to have a meeting on Wednesday and Thursday?
No, Representative Lawrence, just a meeting, our regular meeting time on Thursday, so no meeting tomorrow. Yep. Yeah, I may have, if I said that.
I misspoke.
So regular hearing on Thursday, which is where we will consider amendments and then have a vote on the budget bill. Great question. And any other questions that folks have? Not seeing any. And I think we are still waiting for Commissioner Jett. I'm just verifying that. It sounds like he's on his way. So what I think we will do is start the process of walking through the budget bill. I'm going to ask Representative Cotizza-Witoon to move House File 2476 to bring that before the committee.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cotizza-Witoon. So members, this is the will become the committee's budget bill. There is an A24-0299 amendment, and what's going to happen is that amendment will be adopted on Thursday to become the bill. So although 2476 is before us, I'm going to hold off on adoption of that. So we'll be adopting all the amendments on Thursday. And so the substance of what we're going to walk through then is the A24-0299 amendment. And I wonder if we could perhaps, I'm assuming Ms. Mock, you're going to be the one walking through it, or Ms. Sunderman. Yes, to start. Well, and one thought I had, since Commissioner Jett is on his way, this is a little unusual. Perhaps we would start with the early education article, because that way would lead right into Commissioner Jett's comments. Sounds like I suspect he'll be here in the next, you know, 2 or 3 minutes. So if you understand what I'm saying, and then that way we will have a sense on that. So Ms. Mock, if you can direct us, I'm not sure what page that's on. But again, members, we're looking at the A24-0299 is the document we all should be looking at. And it's page 49 is where the early education article starts. I hope this makes sense to everybody what we're doing, so we can have Commissioner Jett's comments make some sense to us. So Ms. Mock, we'll start with you, starting on page 49.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Annie Mock from House Research. So I'm going to walk through the Article 6, which is the early childhood education article. So Section 1 increases the statutory number of voluntary pre-kindergarten students that may participate in that VPK program in fiscal year 2025 only. So that would go up from 7,160 students to 12,360 students. And that's the number of students that are able to participate under current law beginning in 2026. Section 2 makes modifications to the Early Learning Scholarships Program. This section requires that MDE begin making scholarship payments to providers either before or at the beginning of the delivery of services, rather than after the services have been provided. The section also directs MDE to implement a process for transferring scholarship awards between providers when a scholarship recipient moves between eligible providers. And then MDE is required to have these changes in place beginning January 1st, 2026. This section also directs MDE to have IT systems in place that support specified functions, including an online application for scholarships and the ability to make those prospective payments that I mentioned. Those IT systems must be in place by January 1st, 2026. Section 3 also makes modifications to the Early Learning Scholarships Program. This section removes the caps that are in current law on the amounts of scholarship funds that MDE may use to create and maintain IT systems for early learning scholarships. So in current law, there's a cap of $5 million that MDE can use for creating IT systems, and there's a cap, I believe, of $750,000 each year that MDE can use to maintain those systems. And so those caps are removed so that MDE can use scholarship funds to build IT systems and then maintain them going forward. Section 4 directs MDE to enter into a data sharing agreement with the Department of Revenue to obtain the minimum information necessary for MDE to verify an individual's income for purposes of determining eligibility for early care and learning programs that are administered by MDE, so like the scholarships program, for example. Section 5 allows MDE to use up to 2% of the state's Head Start appropriation for fiscal year 2025 for program administration. And for reference, the state's Head Start appropriation for 2025 is $35.1 million. And then Section 6 just provides, is cleanup language, providing some carry forward authority for the 2024 appropriation to early childhood curriculum grants. And I'll mention that sections 1, 5, and 6 did all come from the governor's budget.
Thank you so much. I was going to make that distinction as well. So as opposed to, yeah, so those are the three sections that the administration advanced. And the other ones are advanced in the budget bill. We'll be able to talk about that, but what did not come from the administration. So I do see that Commissioner Jett is here. And so what I'm inclined to do at this point then is to invite the commissioner to come up. And members will certainly have a chance to ask questions about the content of the budget bill. But Commissioner, yeah, please do proceed to the front of the room. We're so glad to have you with us again. And so once you get settled in, we'll invite any comments you want to have about the administration's early education budget proposal. Welcome to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Willie Jett, and I have the pleasure to serve as the Commissioner of Education. I'd just like to thank you, Chair, for hearing the Governor's Supplemental Education Budget and for the opportunity to share some remarks. As you have heard from my team previously, we have been intensively focused on implementation of the 2023 education budget. In our school site visits across the state, we continue to see and hear about successes and growth from the historic education funding and changes from last year's session. In the supplemental education budget, the governor focused on refining those newly enacted programs, technical but necessary statutory changes, and no-cost ways the state can continue to improve. Many of these supplemental budget proposals reflect changes that need to be made this session. Last year, the legislature, in addition to making 4,000 expiring voluntary pre-kindergarten spots permanent, set aside $50 million for additional voluntary pre-kindergarten seats. This year, the supplemental budget includes the necessary changes to allocate 5,200 seats to districts. Voluntary pre-kindergarten is a critical program to support our preschoolers across the state that can work in partnership with local Head Start and licensed child care programs. We know families and districts alike are asking for more capacity, and so we're excited about the growth of this program over the coming years. The larger supplemental education bill also includes language changes necessary to fully and better implement our other programs. In this bill, that includes allowing up to 2% of Head Start grant funds to be used for administrative and programmatic supports. It also includes allowing the fiscal year 24 early childhood curriculum grant funding to be used in fiscal year 25, a change made in the larger supplemental education budget for numerous grants. I do need to take off now. I do kind of need to sprint, at least they tell me I need to sprint, to testify in the Senate. But I wanted to also make sure to acknowledge the committee's inclusion of all the provisions in your omnibus bill as well. These are straightforward and important change that we need to, that we hope are easy to support. We also appreciate the inclusion of funding to support the summer EBT program and a transition to DCYF to ensure critical services our agency provides can be maintained. And so I'm just thankful for the committee's time today and look forward to continuing to work together to support Minnesota's youngest learners.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. And so, members, my understanding is the commissioner, it sounds like maybe you had went to the wrong building and now you need to run back to the Senate, but the commissioners, but there are, is MDE staff that is available to answer questions that we may have, as opposed to the commissioner himself, but I know deputy commissioners are available.
And so, again, my apologies for my misunderstanding.
No problem,
and
Commissioner.
Yes, MDE staff is here.
All right, it's good. So we do have some experts. Commissioner, thank you so much. We'll get you off to your other hearing. But really appreciate you being with us. And members, you certainly feel free to leave. But members, if there are questions you have regarding MDE proposals at all, folks can certainly ask them now. And of course, other questions regarding the budget bill as things go along. We'll see if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, thank you so much. Yeah. Okay. So not seeing any. So then what we're going to do is go back to the budget bill and back to the A24-0299. We'll go back to the beginning and back to the way that I think the nonpartisan staff presumably assumed that we were going to do this and walk through the bill starting from the beginning. And so we'll do the walk through the budget bill, et cetera, and then go from there. So Ms. Sunderman, I think you're starting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sarah Sunderman from House Research. I'll be walking through Articles 1, 2, and 3 of the bill with the DE. Starting with Article 1, Section 1, this is a clarifying change to existing statute related to the changes later on in the article on child fatality review processes. Going to the bottom of page 3, this is Section 2. This comes from Representative Hansen's bill. This requires the financially responsible agency that applies to be the payee for a child's supplemental security income benefits to provide written notice by certified mail to the child if the child is over 13 years old, the child's next of kin, guardian ad litem, legally responsible agency, and the counsel appointed for the child. It also requires for children over age 13, requires the agency and the guardian ad litem to disclose that the agency receives the benefits in an understandable manner for the child. The section also specifies that the agency must only use the child's SSI benefits to pay for the care of that child and prohibits commingling of those benefits with any other funds. It also requires the financially responsible agency to keep accounting records related to SSI benefits received on behalf of a child, and it lists the information that must be recorded in those records. And finally, it requires each financially responsible agency to submit a report to the commissioner annually, and requires the commissioner to then submit a report to the legislature annually, compiling the information on these benefits received. Moving to Section 3, this is on page 5. This establishes the same requirements as in Section 2, but for a different set of benefits received on behalf of the child. So this would be for retirement, survivor's disability insurance, veterans benefits, railroad retirement benefits, or black lung benefits. Section 4, which is on page 6, again establishes the same notice, disclosure, and use requirements as under Section 2. And this is for benefits received under Section 260C.4411 Subdivision 2. So it's RSDI, SSI for the aged, blind, and disabled, or foster care maintenance payments. This section also requires the county of financial responsibility to keep a record of the total amount it received on behalf of all children for whom the county receives benefits and the total number of children for whom the county receives benefits and to submit an annual report to the commissioner. Moving to Section 5, this is on page 7. This section outlines a new process for child fatality and near fatality reviews. This replaces the existing process. It defines terms for purposes of the section. It requires each county to establish a multidisciplinary local child mortality review team to participate in local critical incident reviews and conduct critical incident reviews jointly with the state child mortality review panel. Subdivision 3 of this section establishes the child mortality review panel and lists the membership of the panel. It also requires the governor to appoint a chair and specifies member terms and removal procedures for the panel. It also requires the commissioner to employ an executive director for the panel to provide administrative support and perform other listed duties for the panel. Subdivision 4 of this section outlines the process for reviewing critical incidents, requires the local welfare agency to report that a critical incident occurred to the commissioner and the panel executive director within 3 business days of when the agency makes a maltreatment determination related to the critical incident. Then requires the panel to conduct a joint review with the local review team for critical incidents that meet the criteria listed in statute. And it requires the local review team to review all critical incidents that are not subject to the joint review with the panel. It then requires the panel or the local review team to complete the joint review or local review and compile a report within 120 days of initiating the review of a critical incident, and specifies what the report must include. And it also requires the local review team to provide its local review report to the panel within 3 business days of completing the report. It allows the panel to make recommendations to any state or local agency, branch of government, or system partner to improve child safety and well-being, and requires the commissioner to conduct additional information gathering at the request of the panel and compile a summary report for each case for which the information gathering is requested. Paragraph I of Subdivision 4 specifies that critical incident reviews proceed as specified in this section, regardless of the status of any pending litigation or active investigation. Subdivision 5 of this section outlines the access to not public data for entities involved in these critical incident reviews, and this is largely the same as is an existing statute. Subdivision 6 of this section requires the commissioner to publish an annual report of the Child Mortality Review Panel and specifies what the report must contain. Subdivision 7 of this section requires the commissioner to provide training, support, and consultation to the panel and to local review teams. And Subdivision 8 requires that local review teams and the panel throughout their work in this area advance and support a culture of learning and improvement within the child welfare system. And this section is effective July 1st, 2025. Moving to section 6 on page 12, this is a technical clarifying change from the governor's budget bill to exception criteria for the minimum basic child support amount. Section 7 is also from the governor's budget bill. This is a technical correction that establishes compensation for Community Resource Center Advisory Council members. And we established those last year in the budget bill. Moving to page 13, section 8, this section outlines the establishment, membership, administration, duties, and required reports for a new Supreme Court Council on Child Protection. Subdivision 1 invites the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to establish the Supreme Court Council on Child Protection. Subdivision 2 outlines the membership and appointing authorities for each member. Subdivision 3 specifies the organization and administration of the council. And Subdivision 4 outlines requirements for council meetings and states that council meetings must begin by September 15th, 2024. Subdivision 5 outlines the duties of the council. The main duty is to develop a comprehensive blueprint for improvement in the child protection system and lists the activities the council must undertake when developing the blueprint. Subdivision 6 requires the council to submit an initial progress report to the legislature, the governor, and the chief justice by January 15th, 2025, and then requires a final report detailing the comprehensive blueprint developed by the council by January 15th, 2026. And subdivision 7 specifies that the council expires upon the submission of its final report. Moving to section 9, this is on page 15. This section directs the commissioner to review and evaluate child maltreatment reporting processes and systems in other states and work with stakeholders to develop recommendations on implementing a statewide common entry point system for reporting child maltreatment in Minnesota. It requires a report to the legislature by December 1st of this year, detailing the commissioner's recommendations, and it requires the commissioner to publish the report on the department's website. Section 10 directs the commissioner to contract with a third-party consultant to conduct a fiscal analysis evaluating Minnesota's child welfare system staffing, resources, financial systems, access to and use of federal funding or reimbursement, and other relevant information related to child welfare funding. It outlines how the consultant must be selected and what the consultant must evaluate, and requires a report on the fiscal analysis and any recommendations by June 30th of 2026. It also specifies that each of Minnesota's 11 federally recognized tribal nations is invited to participate in the fiscal analysis, and that participating tribal nations have sovereignty over any shared data. And finally, section 11 on page 17, this is a handful of sections being repealed related to the new child fatality review process, which recodes some of the existing statutes being repealed. And that concludes the walkthrough for Article 1.
And so if folks have clarifying questions about each article, feel free to ask. Otherwise, we'll also, of course, have a chance to ask more broadly as well. Not seeing any, so let's move on to Article 2. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 2 is the economic supports article. Starting on page 17, Section 1, this is the campus-based employment and training program for students enrolled in higher education. This addresses SNAP eligibility for students enrolled in higher ed. Subdivision 1 directs the Board of Trustees of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota to apply to DHS to verify whether its institutions meet the requirements to be a campus-based employment and training program that would qualify for the student exemption for SNAP eligibility. Subdivision 2 of this section sets out the eligibility criteria a student must meet to participate in a campus-based employment and training program. Subdivision 3 directs DHS, in consultation with the Commissioner of Higher Education, to provide guidance to related to counties, tribal nations, tribal colleges, and public post-secondary institutions on this campus-based employment and training program. And it provides that the guidance must be available within 3 months of when this section becomes effective. Subdivision 4 of this section directs DHS to design an application for higher education institutions to use to apply for a campus-based employment and training program, and provides that the application must be completed within 3 months of when this section becomes effective. Subdivision 5 of this section provides that an institution of higher education with a campus-based employment and training program must send a letter at the beginning of each semester to students eligible under this section to inform them that they may qualify for SNAP benefits. And it makes this section effective upon federal approval. Sections 2 and 3 on page 18. These relate to the FAME program, Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota. Section 2 modifies the definition of household for purposes of the FAME program to include individuals who share finances and use of a dwelling unit, and then clarifies that sharing finances does not include sharing a dwelling without any other sharing of finances. Section 3 modifies household eligibility requirements for FAME to remove a reference to state or TANF matching funds, and replaces that with a reference to federal eligibility requirements with specified maximum income requirements of 200% over the federal poverty guidelines, or 50% of the area median income. And finally, Section 4, this relates to the diaper distribution grant program. This provides that the Diaper Bank of Minnesota may use up to 10% of the grant money for a diaper distribution program that it receives from DHS for administrative costs. And that concludes the walkthrough for Article 2.
And seeing if there are clarifying questions about that article, and not seeing any, so move on to Article 3.
Article 3 is the Housing and Homelessness article. Section 1, which starts on page 21, is the Emergency Shelter Needs Analysis for LGBTQIA plus Youth Experiencing Homelessness. This requires the commissioner to contract with the Wilder Foundation to conduct a needs analysis and site analysis for emergency shelters serving LGBTQIA plus youth experiencing homelessness. It lists the requirement or the criteria to consider when conducting the needs analysis and requires a report to the legislature on the results of the needs and site analysis. And Section 2 requires the Commissioner of Human Services to contract with the Wilder Foundation to conduct a study on the number and needs of pregnant and parenting youth experiencing homelessness and to examine best practices for supporting such youth across settings. Requires the Wilder Foundation to submit a final report to the commissioner and requires the commissioner to submit that report to the legislature. And that concludes the walkthrough for Article 3.
And looking for questions on that article? Not seeing any, so I think we're moving to Ms. Mock then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to walk through Article 4, which is the child care licensing article. This is on page 23. Both of the provisions in this article...
22, I believe.
Perhaps. Sorry, 22. My apologies. Both of the provisions in this article come from the governor's budget proposal. So Section 1 directs the Commissioner of Children, Youth, and Families to establish a weighted risk system that provides a tiered enforcement framework for child care licensing. This is both for family child care providers and child care centers. And under the system, the commissioner would be required to provide technical assistance to a child care provider in lieu of a correction order in certain circumstances when the provider is not in compliance with licensing requirements. And then Section 2 of this section repeals the section of statute that allows the commissioner to issue fix-it tickets, with the idea being that the weighted risk system would be in place of the fix-it ticket system. That is very difficult to say.
Yeah.
So that concludes Article 4.
And just checking for questions on Article 4. Not seeing any, so Article 5.
All right. Article 5 is corrections for the establishment of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Section 1 establishes an intergovernmental advisory committee to give advice to DCYF on providing, funding, and evaluating services for children, youth, and families. So DCYF, along with the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators, would have to come up with and implement a process to administer the committee in a way that represents each county, or to make sure that each county in the state is represented by the committee. The committee would have to meet quarterly, and it would not expire. And that was a proposal from the governor's budget. Sections 2, 3, and 4 all have to do with the ombudsperson for family child care providers and which agency that ombudsperson sort of interfaces with. So Section 2 provides that the ombudsperson's annual report that has to go to DCYF rather than DHS. Section 3 provides that DCYF, again, rather than DHS, has to provide copies of licensing actions that pertain to family child care providers to the ombudsperson. And then Section 4 provides that DCYF, rather again than DHS, has to post the ombudsperson's contact information on its website. And those all are proposals from the governor's budget as well. So moving on to Section 5, I'm actually going to talk about Sections 5 through 12, 15 through 20, and 29 sort of collectively, because I just think they're going to be easier to understand that way than hearing about them one by one. So earlier this session, this committee heard the DCYF recodification bill, which was later signed into law. That law allows DCYF to appoint judges to conduct hearings and recommend and issue orders related to programs administered by DCYF. So it basically allows DCYF to establish administrative and judicial processes. The law also explicitly stated that DCYF could enter into an interagency agreement with DHS for DHS to conduct all of those hearings and recommend orders on behalf of DCYF. So this bill modifies that. So under this bill, DHS would conduct hearings for DCYF and recommend orders to DCYF. And DCF would not have explicit authority to have its own judicial and administrative review processes. So what's in all those sections I just mentioned, 5 through 12, 15 through 20, and 29, are sort of three sets of provisions. One are sort of changes to the recodification law that was passed earlier, or that was signed into law earlier this session, to remove DCYF's explicit authority to appoint judges and conduct hearings. And then there are also sets of changes to statute to give authority to DHS to conduct the hearings and recommend orders on behalf of DCYF. And then there are a bunch of technical cleanup changes just that come along with having to move provisions back and forth. So that is all of those sections. So then I will jump to section 13, which starts on page 35. So this section transfers several programs and functions from DHS to DCYF. So I'll just go through those. So it transfers the American Indian Food Sovereignty Program, the Capital for Emergency Food Distribution Facilities, Community Resource Centers, the Diaper Distribution Grant Program, the Family First Prevention Services Act Support and Development Grant Program, and also that Act's Kinship Navigator Program, the Family First Prevention and Early Intervention Allocation Program, grants for prepared meals food relief, the Homeless Youth Cash Stipend Pilot Project, the Program for Independent Living Skills for Foster Youth, Legacy Adoption Assistance, the Quality Parenting Initiative Grant Program, Relative Custody Assistance, reimbursement to counties and tribes for certain out-of-home placements, and SNAP Outreach. So again, all of that would transfer from DHS to DCYF. Section 14 transfers the Grow Your Own program for early educators to DCYF from MDE. So we've already talked about sections 15 through 20, so I'm going to skip to 21, which starts on page 43. This is one of several sections in this article that recodifies sections of statute that are transferring to DCYF. Section 22 provides for the use of a provider and licensing hub when a DCYF license holder appeals multiple licensing actions or sanctions. And if the committee recalls, last year the legislature established the provider reporting and licensing hub. Sections 23, 24, and 25. All three of those sections just recodify sections of statute, again, that are transferring to DCYF. Section 26 that directs DCYF to designate a leader to be responsible for coordination of services and outcomes around children's mental health and for children with or at risk of disabilities. So that leader would have to coordinate services both within DCYF and then among DCYF and other relevant agencies. And that was another governor's budget proposal. Section 27 is a reviser instruction to correct statutory cross-references. And then section 28, on line 50, or page 50, line 12, that part of this repealer repeals the requirement for a state agency to provide office space and supplies to the ombudsperson for family child care providers. And then there's a few other repealers there, but those other repealers are related to an agency proposal that was not included in this bill, so they need to be removed. And then we've also already discussed section 29 related to the administrative and judicial processes for DCYF. So that concludes Article 5.
Clarifying questions on Article 5. Not seeing any at the moment, and so I guess we're going to Article 7 now because we already talked about Article 6. So, Mr. Berg, looks like you're up.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Doug Berg, House Fiscal Staff. I'll be going through the numbers on the spreadsheet related to the numbers and language in Article 7, which is on page 54 of the amendment. Just to orient members, you should have in your packet a spreadsheet that looks like this. It is labeled Children and Families Budget, House File 2476, and it is the 4/14/24, 9:58 a.m. edition. On the right hand of that are the labels and specific line items. In the middle, the unshaded columns are the governor's recommendations, and I'll be referring to the shaded columns on the right that are the numbers in this amendment. Just one note, it says at the top of the column, the DE1, the coding, as you've heard, is actually 824-0299, but it is, that's what's represented in here. Beginning on lines either 4, 9, or 10, the total expenditure, net expenditure in the general fund is $34,370,024, 24, 25, and $24,770,000 in 26 and 27. Moving down to specific items, on line 134 is the supporting child welfare infrastructure item. This is the beginning of the replacement of SSIS. You'll see the House has got a net $9 million in this item. I will note, if you look at on line 137 is the amount that actually goes into the systems account for the project, not including the staffing that's listed there. This will draw federal funds of approximately just below $8 million, so there will be $16.648 million of funds going to the new system project. That is just the beginning of the cost of the project. On line 140 is the governor's item for the summer EBT program. The funding is the same in this, in the DE, $10.19 million in 24-25 and $10.326 million in the tails. On line 155 is the governor's recommendation for food security, which is the same in this amendment as the governor, $5 million, and is distributed in the same way. That's one-time appropriation for 24-25. Moving on to page 2, on line 161 is the first. We'll come to this is part of the transition to the new Department of Children and Family Service, Children, Youth, and Families. There will be three items in the sheet for this. This is replacing funding and staff at the Department of Human Services that will be lost to them as part of the transition. This is, again, the same as the governor's recommendation of $824,000 in 24-25 and $3.296 million in 26-27. On line 175 is the governor's recommendation for a weighted risk system for licensed child care. That it's the same as the governor's recommendation at $228,000 net general fund cost in 24-25 and $244,000 in 26 and 27. On line 182 is House File 4517, the SNAP eligibility for higher education students item. This has a administrative costs of $95,000 in 24-25 and $222,000 in 26 and 27. On line 187 is House File 3856, which is the foster care notice of benefits item. That has a cost of $136,000 in 24-25 and $68,000 in the tails. On line 192 is House File 4697, which is the chair's mortality review panel changes, the child fatality and near fatality review. That has a cost of $275,000 in 24-25 and $638,000 in 26 and 27. Moving on to page 3. On line 197 is House File 1666, which is the caregiver kinship caregiver support grants item. It has a one-time cost of $760,000 in 24-25. On line 202 is House File 3781, which is the child maltreatment reporting review. That has a one-time net cost of $136,000 in 24 and 25. On line 207 is House File 4192, which is the child welfare fiscal analysis, the third-party analysis. That has a net cost of $170,000 in 24-25. It's a one-time item. On line 212 is House File 4950, which is Representative Keeler's Pregnant and Parenting Homeless Youth Study. That has a net cost of $100,000 in 24 and 25, and again, is a one-time item. On line 217 is House File 5036, the LGBTQIA plus homelessness shelter analysis. That also has a net cost of $100,000 in 24 and 25 and is a one-time item. On line 222 is an additional funding for the emergency services program of $4 million. That is a one-time infusion into the program for the purposes that I believe were gone over earlier. And line 226 is House File 3826, which is the child care services training grants item. That has a net cost of $360,000 in 24-25 and is again a one-time item. On line 230 is a reduction in administrative spending at DHS that represents the net cost of unfilled FTEs. I'll just pause slightly on this. These are FTEs that were related to the children and families portion of House File Chapter 70 from last year. There's an estimate there of it isn't all of the money for that, but there's an assumption, since we're not through the year that yet, that there are positions that will yet be filled. So there was an estimate by the department that there was a total of $4,079,000 related to 2024 in unfilled positions. However, that includes federal financial participation, which, when you go the opposite direction, we have to account for the loss of federal funds. So the reduction of $4,079,000 in costs for those positions nets us $2,774,000 in savings to the state, and then there's an attendant loss of federal funding. Moving to page four, the final item at DHS is a series of the governor's budget neutral technical fixes. I'm not going to go into these, but they represent really just sort of moving around some money, some of which there's a creation of a new budget activity for fraud prevention grants. So some items that were appropriated for that money previously are rescinded and then reappropriated in the new budget activity. Some are just straightening out things like the TANF funding at the bottom, where it's moving from one budget activity to another. This is preparatory to the disaggregation of the department. And again, at the top, they add to zero. They have a net effect on the state budget of zero. That's the end of DHS. Moving to the other agencies in this bill, on line 1992, you'll see the Supreme Court. There's a one-time $800,000 appropriation related to the Child Protection Council that was mentioned previously. On line 2021 is another item partially a item related to summer EBT, and then also the new Department of Children, Families, Youth and Families. These have a net cost of $3.597 million in 24-25 and $1.834 million in 26 and 27. If you look individually on lines 2024, that is the portion of this that is the Department of Education's portion of the summer EBT cost, and on line 2025, actually I said that wrong, it was 2023 is the summer EBT program, and 2024 is the cost of staffing lost at Department of Ed to the switch to Department Children, Families, and Youth, and so they are being increased by $173,000 in 24-25 and $690,000 in TAILS as part of that. And then on line 2040 is a one-time appropriation of $350,000 to the Office of the Family Child Care Ombudsperson. And finally on line 2051 is the Department of Children, Youth, and Families itself, which has got a new appropriation on line 2053 of $3.279 million in 24-25 and $14.061 in the TAILS. However, you'll note that there is FFP. We have a new agency that will be getting FFP at this point. So there is FFP on line 20, as you use the acronym, that's Federal Financial Participation, and I tend to just use the acronyms. Federal Offset Funds, if you want to think of it that way. Line 2054 is the new FFP for the new appropriation, and then we're also recognizing on line 2055 there was an appropriation to the new department in the 23 bill, which where we did not recognize the federal offset. So it's recognized here. So you'll see that the net cost of this item is $1,023,000 in 24-25 and $8,124,000 in the TAILS. And this is ongoing appropriations for the new department. And Mr. Chair, that those are the numbers related to the funding article.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. So members, a couple of clarifying points. So Article 7, the appropriations article in the amendment itself, the A24 amendment, contains the sort of the language that backs up those numbers. I will note that that it's important, members should just look through that, and certainly if you have questions, ask, because in some cases there's some detail in that Article 7 that kind of underlies the numbers that may be important. That's number one. And then the other point I want to make is that the early education part of our bill does not have a net fiscal impact. The administration's proposals in our budget area, none of the ones in that Article 6 that Ms. Mock had walked through have a fiscal impact. I'll ask Ms. Bechtel to confirm that in just a second. There is a provision relating to VPK that would have an impact, but that provision will end up going through the education finance budget, and so it's not carried in our budget. But Ms. Bechtel, can you just confirm what I'm saying there, that we don't need to, kind of, that doesn't have an impact on our target for education provisions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Sylvia Beckel, House Fiscal. Yes, much of Article 6 in this bill is also being carried in Article 10 of the Education Finance Bill, and all of the voluntary pre-kindergarten provisions are being carried in the Education Finance Bill, where the costs for voluntary pre-kindergarten are also being carried in full. So this committee would not need to carry the voluntary pre-kindergarten costs at all.
Ms. Bechtel, I guess what I'm confirming though is that and then the other provisions though that are within our jurisdiction do not have a fiscal impact. There's not a, there are no cost fiscal items, correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you much. So any questions anybody has before we move on to public testimony? Not seeing any, and so we will have folks. I'm going to ask members of the public to keep your remarks to 2 minutes, please, and we'll just go in the order it's in our agenda. So, Angie Teese, we'll have you come up first, if you can. Thanks. And then we'll have Commissioner Brown will be up after you. And so once you get settled in, I'm so glad to have you with us, and if you can just identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony. Thanks so much.
Good morning, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
For the record, my name is Angie Teese, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, or AMC, and the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, or MACSA. Together in Minnesota's county-administered system, we represent the 87 counties and our human service leadership across the state. With that backdrop, I thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today on House Bill 2476. AMC and MACSA strongly support the establishment of an Intergovernmental Advisory Council for the DCYF, and thank this body and DCYF leadership for recognizing the importance of intergovernmental partnership. We appreciate the critical incident review approach adjustment and the work to conduct a national maltreatment intake process. Counties strongly support conducting a comprehensive child welfare fiscal analysis and encourage members to also consider including practice modeling in the proposal. Counties support the establishment of a Child Protection Advisory Council led by the Minnesota Supreme Court. While not named, we are hopeful that AMC and MACSA will be considered strong partners and that the scope will include the role that economic and community-based supports have, like community resource centers, in preventing child welfare and child protection involvement. With regards to the case plan summary and the SSI and RSDI notification provisions, MACSA and AMC support the policy direction, but as we've shared in committee testimony, without modernization, dare I say an overhaul of the Social Service Information System, or SSIS, the provisions called for will result in manual processes for notification and reporting, impacting an already overburdened workforce. The most significant and transformative opportunity in this area for families, our workforce, and to make informed decisions is to invest in a replacement technology platform. While we are thankful for the $9 million that has been included in this budget, AMC and MACSA encourage members to support the governor's supplemental proposal at $15 million. Oh, I'm eating up seconds. Thank you. Sorry.
That's okay. Yeah. There are a few minutes where if you could just kind of wrap up. Yeah.
For sure.
Thank you.
In conclusion, I'd like to thank Chair Pinto, Vice Chair Keeler, and members of the committee for engaging with our members. Counties truly are where the rubber meets the road, and I hope that you will continue to keep the local perspective and impact front and center as you continue deliberations and decision-making this session.
Thank you so much. Yeah, just one second. Representative Nelson, you had...
Okay, got it.
Thank you so much. And Commissioner Brown, you're on your way up, and then Peter Wojtok, if you can kind of be on deck and ready to go. So Commissioner Brown.
All right.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tiki Brown. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity to share some brief remarks this morning on the House Children and Families Supplemental Budget Bill. We are especially grateful for the inclusion of several of the governor's key supplemental budget priorities. In particular, we would like to thank you for including a portion of the governor's recommendation to begin modernizing and replacing the Social Services Information System, or SSIS. This will help us begin to ease the administrative burden on frontline child welfare workers. We would also like to thank you for including the administrative and information technology infrastructure needed to implement summer EBT beginning in summer of 2024. We're also happy to see the governor's recommendations for $5 million in additional funding for food banks, food shelves, and tribal food security, funding that will help bridge the gap in food support. We are grateful you have included the tiered weighted risk system for licensed childcare, which will result in greater consistency among childcare licensors and the reviews of childcare programs. Mm-hmm. Finally, we are very pleased to see additional funding for one of the governor's highest priorities, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. This investment will help ensure that the new agency has the resources it needs to succeed as it gets up and running. However, not all language for the new department's budget bill was included in the House legislation. The missing provisions are necessary for implementation of the new agency, and we respectfully request that they be incorporated at markup. As this bill continues to make its way through the legislative process, we hope you will reconsider a few priorities that either didn't make it onto the bill or could use additional attention, including providing the full $15 million recommended by the governor to improve SSIS, and ensuring compliance with the recent federal changes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, or the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF, and Title IV-E. Thank you again, Chair Pinto, and members of the committee, for your important work serving Minnesota's children and families.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Thanks for all of your work. Appreciate it. Peter Wojtok, you're up, and then Zach Radvold will be up after that. As you get settled in, yeah, please identify yourself and proceed. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Peter Wojtok, Government Relations with Hunger Solutions, the Advocacy Wing of the Food Group. And we first want to thank Representative Keeler for her commitment and leadership on tackling hunger in our state, and to Chair Pinto and the committee for including additional support in this bill for one-time funds for the Minnesota Food Shelf and food bank programs and tribal food assistance. This comes course, at a vital time for many food shelves across the state, where visits have increased to over 7.5 million and causing a significant strain on food shelves to try to keep up with the huge demand. And so this investment would make an immediate impact to food shelves to ensure that they're able to keep food in their food shelves stocked, deliver food to those who need it across the state. So we want to thank you for that, and also thank the committee for the inclusion of summer EBT and increasing access to college SNAP. Summer EBT will help provide food to many low-income families during the summer months by reaching over 300,000 children and bringing in over $38 million from the federal government into our local economy. And by including House File 4517, we can help more college students to qualify for SNAP and put food on the table for many who are struggling right now. So as hunger in our state continues to rise, we are grateful for your support. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Wojtok. And Zach Rodvold, you're on your way up. And then Lorna Schmidt will be after that. And once you get settled in, please identify yourself. I'm glad to have you. Glad to have you with us. Please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Zach Rodvold. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for Second Harvest Heartland. If you have heard from us consistently for more than a year, and as Peter just mentioned, demand for emergency food assistance is at record levels in our state, and it's still rising, with 2024 on pace to be the new hungriest year on record in Minnesota, after having set that record each of the last 2 years. So we support many of the investments made in this bill that would address some of those challenges, including, of course, summer EBT and the $2 million for the emergency food shelf program, which was the same amount included in our bill, as well as the $1 million for the Tribal Food Sovereignty Program. However, Minnesota's Feeding America food banks express our deep and profound disappointment that additional investments in food banks have not been made a greater priority either in the last legislative session or this one, despite record demand for assistance and food and resources available. The $2 million in one-time funding included in for the state's six food banks falls far short of the modest ask that we came forward with this year, an ask which was far short of the actual need. And the reality is it would be spent in a matter of weeks. A choice is being made here to save a handful of millions of dollars per year rather than put that money to work addressing one of the most basic needs of Minnesotans, which is reliable access to nutritious food. That is why that we say hunger is a policy choice. It cannot be solved by the charitable food system alone. To end hunger, we need government to step in and help out, particularly in times of extraordinary need. Many of the investments made in the 2023 legislative session are helping, but the reality is that hunger is on the rise and the work is far from complete. And so on behalf of the five Feeding America food banks who collectively serve every county and every community in our state, and with the hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans experiencing food insecurity right now in mind, I implore you to do whatever you can to convince the governor and leaders in the House and the Senate to work together to find the resources necessary for this committee to fully fund our very modest but still very meaningful request this year. And if we do not, the reality is more Minnesotans will go hungry tomorrow than are going hungry today. Thank you for the opportunity to appear today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thanks for your important work, Mr. Rodvold. Appreciate you being here. So Lorna Schmidt, you're up next, and then it'll be Marwa Asif after that. Thanks. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Great. Thank you, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. My name is Lorna Schmidt, and I'm the Vice President of Public Policy and Government Affairs with Catholic Charities Twin Cities. I'm here today to say thank you for your continued commitment to prioritizing homelessness and food insecurity as part of your supplemental budget and its impact on our neighbors in crisis. Earlier this session, we were here to talk about the impact of last year's investments on the emergency shelter system. We acknowledge that there's so much to do, though, and more individuals in crisis who need help today. In 2023, Catholic Charities Twin Cities served more than 25,000 youth and adults. More than half of those sought help through our overnight and daytime shelter programs. We saw a 37% increase in the number of people served at our St. Paul Opportunity Center alone. And we saw more than 5,000 people seek help through our shelter diversion programs. At the same time, we are seeing one-time public funding come to an end. Preserving and strengthening this piece of our state safety net will ultimately require exploring new and more predictable funding models for shelter operations. We know that some of those conversations are already happening, and we're grateful to have been part of them. We also know they require more time and resources than this session allows. We want to continue those conversations, just as we want to continue parallel talks about how we can simplify and reform systems to improve outcomes and ROIs on housing and homelessness programs. But what providers need right now is your help to buy time and keep doors open so that those in need can access the most basic of needs, shelter and food. The investments included here for emergency services funding and food insecurity will save lives and keep us moving forward. We appreciate your support, and we look forward to working with you this session to see them through. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your work in all kinds of ways. Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. And Marwa Asif is our last testifier. So glad to have you with us. And once you get settled in, you can please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Pinto, Ranking Member Daniels, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marwa Asif. I am a St. Cloud State University student and the state chair for Students United, the statewide student association representing all current, former, and future Minnesota State University students. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today supporting Representative Keeler's House File 4517, which is included in the Children, Youth, and Families Omnibus Bill. Students United has also submitted a joint letter supporting the legislation, which is included in the members' packets. This bill is critical for many students across our state. As a Pell recipient myself, I know that the only reason I am able to afford and go to college is because of that grant. But the struggle for college is more than just the bill we get at the end of our semester. Countless students across our system deal with food insecurity every single day. And while we know we can get that 52-cent ramen from Walmart, is that really what we deserve? Many of our peers and classmates live with the daily burden of battling food insecurity. It's challenging for many of the students that I know who have been turned away from SNAP benefits because of arbitrary and burdensome requirements. SNAP benefits have forgotten about college students. And while students can hardly afford tuition, books, fees, housing, transportation, we must not allow food to be on that list as well. I'm here today urging you to support Representative Keeler's House File 4517, because with this bill, legislators can help hungry students. This legislation would significantly impact our students across our state, including me and my peers over at St. Cloud State University. We need broader access to SNAP benefits, and this clarification would achieve that goal. So thank you, Representative Keeler, for your leadership on this, and thank you, Chair Pinto, for the opportunity to testify.
Marwa Asif, thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for your advocacy for your fellow students, past, current, and future. Good stuff. So, members, that concludes our public testifiers, and so we'll go to member questions. Representative Nelson. And we had posted previously asking if for folks to sign up in advance if they had testimony. We certainly, of course, will continue to receive input. And I actually, Marwa Asif had referenced this, but just want to note to folks that there are some letters in our member packets and posted online as well with input as well. So moving to Representative Nelson.
All right, thank you, Chair Pinto. And you can probably guess what I'm going to talk about. The SSIS system, and, you know, it's, I know we don't have a big target, or, you know, it's not large. You know, we got about 34 and a half million. And, you know, about half of that is being, you know, requested by the governor's office for the SSI system. And I want to reiterate that I think it's something that we invest in and, you know, put as much funding into that as we can. I think if we're not careful, we're going to end up buying something off of Temu or something like that. And, you know, you never know what you're going to get when you do that. You know, and it's just, it's something that, you know, we need to make sure this, with as comprehensive the system is that we put, the correct amount of funding into it. And I think we're short on it right now. And I think, anything we can do to bolster that is something that we need to look at.
Thank you, and I should probably have clarified for folks. So we will have a full markup and amendments and discussion and debate on the bill on Thursday. So this is probably a better, I might have thoughts to engage with you on that, and we can have a full committee conversation, but probably this is a good time. If folks have questions about the content of the bill, et cetera, and then certainly on Thursday we'll have a chance to offer amendments and discussion and debate, and happy to engage with you on the point you've made. So just kind of want to clarify that. Representative Elizabeth, how are you up next?
Thank you, Chair. You know, my question is just really surrounding the implosion on the family child care. You know, we have three critical components for the state of Minnesota, and we always have family child care, center-based child care, and the voluntary pre-K. And while I appreciate and I understand the voluntary pre-K expansion for the 33-month and older, and it's a fantastic model, what I've learned, and I think that we need to be transparent, is that parents look at this parent aware rating. And what I found to be surprising, being on this committee when I've researched, is that the schools have an automatic 4-star rating. They simply have to do a statement of assurance. However, that same level of trust is not extended to families or centers. So, and there's not even a verify piece. Trust and verify would be fine, but the schools aren't surveyed. They're not doing the steps. So we have a triangle that has different standards for three, for one group, and the other two are doing a completely different model. That to me is problematic, and it's also problematic in my mind to the families of knowing what that 4-star means.
Can I ask you, do you have a question to clarify about the bill? Just because we'll get a chance to definitely engage on the budget bill, but I just, are there...
I think from a policy standpoint, that yeah. needs to be, transparency needs to be a part of that in that 4-star piece.
Okay, yeah, and
we're expanding the voluntary pre-K program.
Do you have a, you're provoking a question in my mind, actually, I'm going to ask Ms. Beckel, but did you have a question for staff or for anybody else about the content of the bill at all at this point? Or
The question is there going to be language that explains that piece on the voluntary pre-K? Because the reality is the process is different, and the public should know that the process is different, because we use parent aware as a 4-star grading. And we're using it is a K through 12 setting, and so those things are exempt. That's my question.
Okay, so I don't believe there is language like that in the bill currently. Maybe Ms. Mock, you can confirm, is there anything in this on the bill currently?
No, there is not.
Okay, and so certainly that would be something you could offer as an amendment. I will, this will be on Thursday, so the amendment deadline being tomorrow. I will ask Ms. Beckel, though, just regarding pre-K, my understanding is that last session there was $50 million that was set aside for pre-K. And so what's being spent, and again, this isn't coming out of our target and our budget, but we do have some jurisdictional authority over the policy of EPK. And I think what's advancing, Ms. Beckel, is ending up being about $42 million for EPK, roughly, this session. And just because I know it's of great interest to Representative Lesnikar and others. So actually, what's going to end up being coming out net for EPK is actually less than what was allocated last year. This is across the legislature, obviously not just in our budget area, but can you just kind of clarify where things stand in terms of decisions being made this year as compared to last year regarding VPK? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. Yes, last year in 2023 laws, Chapter 55, there was a $50 million voluntary pre-kindergarten reserve established. It was put into statute that this would pay for roughly 3,000 voluntary pre-kindergarten seats. Over time, both the agency and the legislature realized that this would pay for far more than 3,000 voluntary pre-kindergarten seats. The Department of Education and Minnesota Management and Budget established at the beginning of this year that it would pay for 5,200 new voluntary pre-kindergarten seats if they put toward the voluntary pre-kindergarten seats exactly 37.996 million towards the program in fiscal year 2025 and 4.128 million towards the program in fiscal year 26. So over the course of both biennia, it is roughly 42 million. So 42.124 million is what is being spent instead of the full 50 million that was set aside in fiscal year 23.
That's helpful, thank you. So maybe just as helpful clarification, Representative Lesnikar, it sounds like we're actually a cut in the investment in VPK compared to what was expected last year, $50 million set aside. It's actually only going to be $42 million of that that's used. Again, that's not coming out of our target, but it is related to the work that we do and because of your interest with VPK. I don't know if there's other questions folks have, or we could and maybe we can get some clarification. Yeah, Representative Hudson, we'll go to you. And if there's time, we maybe get some clarification also regarding the rating process Representative Zalesnikar was asking about. But Representative Hudson, we'll go to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question related to Article 3, Section 1. I notice that this looks like the bill we heard from Representative Finke, and I noticed that the contract is now with the Wilder Foundation as opposed to, I believe it was, I forget the name of the group we were talking about before.
Our Spaces, maybe?
Our Spaces, yeah, that makes
Our
sense.
Space, yeah.
I'm just getting clarification that that is indeed what happened, that we swapped out Our Spaces with Wilder Foundation in that bill.
Thank you for the question, Representative Hudson. I feel like there may be a couple of other changes as well. I think in a number of these, the bill gets introduced by the author, and we hear it, and then as I'm deciding what I want to propose to the committee for consideration, I'm making various adjustments, really trying to do so in consultation with the author, which I certainly did in this case. And so, yeah, I forget the exact language, but I do recall that it was Our Space that that contract would have been with, and the bill is introduced, and it's Wilder here. I'll maybe give a little preview that it might end up not being Wilder, actually, and maybe having an author's amendment to make an adjustment there. But in any case, yeah, I believe that's kind of how we at least got to this step. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, Chair Pinto. And just coming from the conversation that we had when we heard that bill regarding the bona fides of the organization, Wilder Foundation is obviously much more known quantity. And as we move forward, hopefully something like that will be retained. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thomas. I think there were several reasons that that adjustment was made. But yeah, so folks should certainly review each of the provisions carefully because there may be changes from how the bill was introduced for various reasons. But thank you. Yeah. Other questions that folks may have? So I think I may just ask on behalf of Representative Zalesnikar, if you don't mind, if there is somebody from the agency who could just, when I say the agency, I suppose I'm thinking DHS, but whoever oversees Parent Aware, just to talk a little bit about that rating process. If you're Ms. Sommerfeld, I think you're so often in the hot seat and you are in this one as well. But since we have some time and had a member who raised concerns and questions about this, and I'll just ask, and again, this is just for clarification, if you can just talk about that rating process, if you're the right person to do so. It does occur to me I could have asked Ms. Mock probably as well, but I guess as long as I called you up, we could, we'll give it a try. But Ms. Sommerfeld, if you feel like, hey, maybe not so much in your expertise, I can certainly turn to Ms. Mock, but if you can help us out.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Jennifer Sommerfeld with the Department of Human Services, and Parent Aware fits into the work that we do. So I'm not an expert. What I will say is the reason there's a 4-star automatic Parent Aware rating for schools is that schools in statute are already required to meet comparable requirements to Parent Aware. So they're meeting those requirements under different laws. But Ms. Mock might have more specific.
She may have. It is occurring. I should have thought of that in the first place. So my apologies. I'm still, Representative Zalesnikar, I'm just trying to get some additional help as to why, at least the rationale. We can all disagree and we can have a amendment on Thursday, et cetera, but at least we can at least hear sort of what the understanding is. But I'll go back to you, Representative Zalesnikar, if you have other questions, Ms. Mock or Ms. Sommerfeld.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that information. My question is, with the 33-month-old children coming, in addition to the school, K through 12, is there any department surveys that go on that would be similar to the family child care and the center-based child care?
To
verify the processes that we do for Parent Aware. Are there any inspections like family child care, center child care for that group of children that are now moving to the voluntary pre-K?
Inspections of public schools, Ms. Sommerfeld.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Representative Zalesnikar, I don't know that I have an answer for that. I'll have to work with our folks as far as what goes on for inspections or work that we do with school-based child care.
There's obviously a ton of oversight of our public schools, as we know, but Representative Zalesnikar, other questions from Ms. Sommerfeld? Or is, again, Ms. Mock, is it as well?
No further questions, thanks.
All right, thanks. Okay, seeing if we have any other questions from anybody. So again, the plan is that amendment deadline tomorrow, 1 p.m. We'll be back on Thursday for amendments. I'll maybe just one comment as we're considering all that. I think, well, it came through to me during the testimony that there's a number of areas where I would very much like us to be increasing funding. The problem is that there are a number of areas, and they're all balancing out against one another. That's what we'll have to decide as a committee on Thursday, but just recognizing the challenge when we hear so many important needs. So, Representative Perez-Vega, yeah, to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify and give kind of praise to our committee for prioritizing on this as a committee in regards to emergency services program funding for homelessness. And I want to thank the testifier from Catholic Charities. This is a crisis that's happening, and we're seeing it, and I'm just going to keep addressing it in this committee. We have to focus on putting some funding to address our homelessness. It's not a this county versus this county. It's we need some support, and let's have folks have an opportunity to apply for those services. So thank you for that.
And thank you, Representative Perez-Vega. And you've actually reminded me to give a big thank you to our incredible nonpartisan staff. So you've heard from a number of them. I often, though, forget to thank our incredible revisors staff as well. Dean Tvedt, I hope I'm saying this last name correctly, and Cassandra Rooney, Cassie Rooney, who worked incredibly hard to pull this together as they do every year. And I often forget that, and I should not, because they do incredible, incredible work. So thanks to all of them. So members, we'll see one another on Thursday, members of the public as well. Thank you so much, and with that, the committee is adjourned.